Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso. We open our show today with an update on wildfires burning statewide and some special requests from CAL FIRE for people in our region. On Green Scene, learn about efforts by Supervisor Diane Jacob and a coalition of environmental groups who are seeking to preserve lands for the public in Lakeside's El Monte Valley. From Public News Service, we have some troubling news about air quality in California. We also have a weekly weather forecast, which is looking warm, wet, and wild. And speaking of wild, if you're looking to adopt a dog, cat, or other pet, we'll tell you about Clear the Shelters Day coming up, when animals will be free for adoption at shelters countywide. On Tribal Beat, Leon Thompson interviews Erica Pinto, the newly elected chair of the Hamul Indian Village and the first woman to hold that honor. She'll tell us what life was like growing up on the rural reservation and about her vision for leading her tribe into a brighter future. Also on Tribal Beat, we'll hear from Richard St. Jean, manager of the Hollywood Hamul Casino, now under construction, with a sneak preview of the casino and an update on local jobs coming soon. On our Crime Beat report, hear about a drunk driver who caused multiple accidents in Lemon Grove before he was apprehended. Hear how your security could be compromised if you're using Wi-Fi in public places. Then on People Power, Janice Mork talks with Mary Libby from the Holly Veterans Center in El Cajon about their efforts to help homeless veterans and about a new study on the effects of aging on PTSD. We'll also have some tips for you from Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna on what you should know if you have to evacuate during a wildfire. Today we'll also be replaying a very special Animal Tales segment with Mimi Pollack interviewing Ramona resident Roy Toft, an internationally famous wildlife photographer best known for his special report on tigers, published in National Geographic. We hope you'll enjoy today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. More than 10,000 firefighters are battling over 17 active wildfires statewide. The largest of these, the Rocky Fire, has consumed nearly 70,000 acres in Lake, Colusa, and Yolo counties. Thunder and lightning continue to spark new fires, while gusty and erratic winds could also create extreme fire growth potential, says Fire Captain Kendall Bortiser, Public Information Officer at CAL FIRE. CAL FIRE San Diego continues to support the Northern California wildfires with fire engines, bulldozers, hand crews, and support personnel. However, Captain Bortiser says, we are committed to ensuring that all firefighting resources are in place here in San Diego County as a top priority. Days off have been canceled for all CAL FIRE firefighters, and off-duty firefighters have been recalled back to work. Additionally, all 18 CAL FIRE stations throughout San Diego County are staffed, he adds. CAL FIRE is asking all residents to be careful outdoors. Even simple household chores, like cutting down dead, dry grass, can spark a wildfire if not done the right way, with the right tool. To learn more, you can visit readyforwildfire.org. This has been Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine show on KNSJ.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Leon Thompson with the Green Scene Report. The San Diego River Conservancy Board voted unanimously last week to support a motion made by Supervisor Diane Jacob to lead a consortium of environmental groups in an effort to buy parcels of surplus land that Helix Water District is planning to sell. If successful, the acquisition would preserve the land for the public as open space with trails for hiking, horseback riding, jogging, and dog walking. The lands are adjacent to a 200-acre property proposed for a controversial sand mining project by a group called the El Monte Nature Preserve LLC. The parcel that environmentalists and trail enthusiasts hope to acquire total 37 acres and have an appraised value of over $550,000. The coalition would include the nonprofit Lakeside River Park Conservancy, Lakeside Frontier Riders, San Diego Trail Alliance, and San Diego River Park Foundation, as well as the San Diego River Conservancy. Lakeside residents and representatives of equestrian and environmental groups filled the meeting room to show support for the project, which was opposed by Michael Beck, co-owner of the entity seeking to sand mine the valley. Beck acknowledged, "There are a lot of people in this room, some of them very upset with me," but then argued that trail restoration should be left to his company after mining is completed many years in the future. Supervisor Jacob, a member of the San Diego River Conservancy Board, disagreed. El Monte Valley is a beautiful valley, she said, adding, "I definitely think that the opportunity is before us to take public ownership." She then proposed the idea of creating a coalition of interested parties to buy and preserve the land. Trish Disnan, a teacher whose family has lived in El Monte Valley for over 100 years, urged the Conservancy Board to be honest in your actions and transparent about any ties to the El Monte Nature Preserve sand mine interests, a reference to Beck, whose dealings while serving as a Conservancy Director and Chair and now being co-partner in the company seeking to sand mine the river valley have sparked criticism and controversy. Disnan said her students will be looking at what happens with this land. "I hope the legacy is a grand one," she concluded.
As smoke from multiple wildfires chokes the air across California this summer, air quality is a hot topic. But the biggest source of pollution is the state's 33.5 million vehicles. The state is moving aggressively to promote air quality, especially in the wake of a report from the National Parks Conservation Association that gave Yosemite, Joshua Tree, Sequoia, and Kings Canyon an F for air quality and said they regularly have unhealthy ozone levels. Ula Reeves is the National Parks Conservation Association's Clean Air Campaign Manager.
Between oil and gas plants and vehicles in particular are a huge problem in California. All of this pollution piles up together and contributes to degraded air quality.
Governor Jerry Brown set a goal last year of putting 1 million zero-emissions cars on the road by 2023. To that end, he signed a bill making electric cars more affordable. 3 years ago, the state mandated that 15% of cars sold in California be all-electric, hybrid, or hydrogen vehicles starting in 2018. Reeves says the Clean Air Act's regional haze rule needs to be tightened up to force additional action on this issue around the country.
That rule, unfortunately, has some loopholes and weaknesses that are allowing states and polluters to essentially game the system and often avoid cleaning up. So we're calling on the Obama administration to strengthen the regional haze rule.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce has criticized the regional haze rule as too stringent, complaining that it has stood in the way of construction of hundreds of new power plants. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
This is Miriam Raftery with the Weekly Weather Outlook. A heat wave is forecast to hit our region starting midweek, with heat advisories possible by week's end. A high-pressure system could bring temperatures above 100 degrees in inland valleys as well as deserts. The National Weather Service is also forecasting thunderstorms with heavy rain, strong winds, and dangerous lightning possible on Wednesday and Thursday over the mountains and deserts in East County, according to meteorologist James Brotherton. So be sure to drink plenty of water and stay hydrated. Avoid strenuous outdoor activities during excessive heat. And remember, when thunder roars, stay indoors, since lightning can travel up to 10 miles. Oh, and one more thing. The Perseid meteor shower will also be putting on an astronomical light show that peaks this week with largely clear skies for your viewing enjoyment.
Thinking about getting a pet? Mark Saturday, August 15th on your calendar. County Animal Services is among more than a dozen local organizations taking part in Clear the Shelters, a one-day, all-out push in cities across the country aimed at getting every shelter animal into homes. For that day only, County Animal Services is waiving all adoption fees on its pets for qualified applicants, and that includes a spay or neuter, vaccinations, a microchip, and a free veterinary exam. That means puppies, kittens, cats, dogs, rabbits, guinea pigs, hamsters, and turtles are available at no cost to anyone offering a good home. Any homeless animal at County Animal Services is available. It even has a bearded dragon, a rooster, ducks, and a horse up for adoption. In addition to County Animal Services, 14 other local shelters are involved in this first-of-its-kind pet adoption event for this region. A similar campaign in the Dallas-Fort Worth area last year led to the adoption of more than 2,200 homeless animals, the most ever in one day in North Texas. This year, NBC TV is taking the Clear the Shelters effort nationwide and including more than 300 shelters. Typically, County Animal Services takes in some 23,000 homeless animals a year. Currently, about 1,000 pets are available for adoption in its three animal care facilities located in Bonita, Central San Diego, and Carlsbad. The Clear the Shelters event takes place from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Saturday, August 15th, but county animal facilities will be open at the regular time of 9:30 a.m. So get in line early and get first pick. The county also is offering coupons for discounted spay or neutering through August 31st. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Leon Thompson.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, networking for social justice.
This is East County Magazine's Tribal Beat, bringing you news for and about our region's Native American communities. This is Leon Thompson with East County Magazine, and today it's our honor and special privilege to have the chairwoman of the Hamul Indian Village with us, Ms. Erica Pinto. Welcome.
Thank you, Leon. Good morning.
And we have with us Richard St. Jean, the general manager of the Hollywood Casino Hamul.
Thank you, Leon. Nice to be here.
It's nice to have the two of you here. There's been so much activity out there in Hamul. Every time I drive by, springing from the earth is this Hollywood Hamul Casino. Before we begin talking about the casino, I'd like to talk to you, Chairwoman Pinto. As the first woman chairperson of Hamul Indian Village, tell us a little bit about your history.
Yes, I'm the first elected woman of the Hamul Indian Village. I've been on council since I was 21, and that was in 1996. I've been in the background of the tribal council, and I'm now the elected chairwoman, and it's a whole different ballgame to be where I'm at.
What did you start out doing?
I started out as a secretary for the tribe. The former chairman, who was my uncle, Raymond Hunter, he gave me that opportunity to come in and answer phones and file, and I did, and then I thought, I'm going to run for council. At 21, I got in council, and I've been in ever since.
Were you the youngest ever?
Yes, I was both the youngest and the first woman.
And did you grow up in the village?
I did. I grew up in the village from 75 to the early 80s.
What was that like?
It was a whole other world being there, and from coming off the reservation to it was very poor, but we were happy, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
We had nothing, but I had my mother, my father, my brothers, right. And we were happy there.
Yes. I grew up in Cass Lake, Minnesota. We were poor, dirt floors, some of our homes. And that was the way it was in the Hamul Indian Village in the 70s and the 80s.
Dirt floors, no electricity, no running water, well water. We drink well water. And so when electricity came in and the plumbing came in, we were so happy to be able to go to the bathroom indoors.
Uh-huh.
No black widows.
You were run out of your home one time by black widows?
We were run out of the outhouse by black widows. They used to like to sit in the bottom.
You went to which school there?
I went to Oak Grove Middle School, and then I went to Valhalla.
As the new tribal leader, what's your vision for any new direction in which you'd like to lead the tribe?
My vision and my hope as the leader of the tribe is to allow the tribe to become self-sufficient, economically independent, and be able to venture out into other businesses after we open 2016. And once we start generating revenue, I hope it's going to bring on a lot of opportunities for the tribe to expand our land base, to build housing, to get better health care, to allow the children and adults who want to go to school to get that education. So I hope to diversify once we start generating revenue.
The Hamul Indian Village has had a long history in East County. Can you tell us a little bit about the history?
Sure. We can trace our roots back 12,000 years. We were federally recognized in 1981. Originally there were about 23 people in the village, and now there's 53 tribal members. And we're continuing to grow, which is why this project is so important for us and able to get better housing and better health and better education. And we're continuing to grow.
And what are you doing about reviving the Kumeyaay, Pamul Indian cultural heritage?
Well, my brother and I run a program called Acorns to Oaks. And that is a program that we get all the kids of the tribe, and we open it up to other reservations. And we programs that focus on the culture, making gourds. Gourds are what bird singers use for the cultural songs, the traditional songs. And we focus on technology. We focus on life skills. We focus on drugs and alcohol, making sure they don't go that route. So that's how we're trying to revive our culture, is through a series of classes and different programs that my brother Chris and I run.
And for the community, when the casino opens, that will open up some opportunities for employment in the area. Can you tell us something about that?
Sure. First and foremost, that will open up our employment for tribal members. And then I think we're going to have about 1,000 jobs that will, you know, be on the website. If you look right now, there's all kinds of jobs that are available and will become available once we open in mid-2016.
And our goal is obviously to hire locally first and foremost, and then expand the search from there. So very committed to hiring locally, buying locally, and supporting local businesses.
What can you tell us about the traffic? Can you tell us a little bit about what's being done to mitigate that?
Yes, Penn National, the Pamul Indian Village, Caltrans have been working very closely on the impact studies and the resulting modifications to SR Route 94. They've got a great plan. They've been terrific to work for. As a matter of fact, they had the public hearing just this Wednesday evening that was, you know, not attended by a great number of people, about 80, 85 residents from the Pamul area. Some very interested in how it may or may not impact, others, you know, more vocal about the project. But Caltrans is very excited to, you know, be near that in the end of that process to start that road work so we can get much of it done before our opening in the summer of 2016. So I think that from the site working backwards on 94 towards Rancho San Diego, you'll see some neat improvements that should help alleviate those concerns.
I saw that on your website that the road would be widened in certain places. There would be turn lanes added. There would be better signage and signals.
That's right. I think some of the bigger concerns are obviously the cross-traffic movement, so relative to left turns from the right lane, so on and so forth. So that's where, you know, they're widening, they're adding turn lanes and the lights in order to create a safer environment at the intersections, which allow for better flow for the people driving through.
Well, what are some of the exciting things we're going to see in this new Hollywood casino?
Oh, it's a very, very exciting project. And you know, JIV has been very responsive to, you know, public feedback and reducing the height of the building, you know, muted earth tones, down lighting. So although it looks like a big building from the road when it's said and done, and for those that have seen renderings, it's a beautiful exterior that really blends well with its surroundings. A great sense of arrival. It's a property that's easy to get to, closest proximity to downtown. Great flow for an 8-story subterranean parking garage that we're building simultaneously with a casino floor. But we'll feature 1,700 slots, 50 table games, so not extraordinarily large casino floor. It'll be supported by a food court that we hope to partner with local restaurateurs to bring a local flavor into our food court. Mm-hmm. We're very close to penciling a deal with a local sports celebrity, which we are very anxious to announce in the near future.
Oh.
We'll have an Asian restaurant with traditional Asian offerings. And then we'll have the Hollywood Casino Final Cut Steak and Seafood, ooh, which is our signature restaurant we have in many of our Hollywood properties. And then we'll have a beer garden, indoor-outdoor mixed-use facility featuring local and international brews.
Oh, wow.
That overlook the beautiful landscape. And then we'll have an entertainment lounge on the casino level that we're very excited to start exploring local acts and featuring local groups. So it's got all the neat amenities. Again, it's not a huge casino, so it'll be a little more intimate. We'll really focus, again, on partnering locally, hiring locally, and offering local products.
So it's going to have this Hollywood in the 60s type of glitz to it? Is it?
More the 30s.
Maybe like very the golden age of
bright.
Hollywood, right?
And I welcome anyone to look up HollywoodCasino.com, and they can see it's taken on the traditional look of many of our other properties like Toledo, Columbus, our Speedway property, but it's got a little bit of a more modern touch than some of our other properties.
Well, maybe I could ask you this, since you come from a similar project in Ohio.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about your experience there working, creating a casino in Ohio?
Well, you know, those were state-run, or state, they weren't tribal casinos.
Oh, okay.
However, being new to the state, there was your expected opposition. A lot of people were excited. It was voted by public referendum to have gaming. And we came in and we heard the positive and we heard the negative, the concerns about crime and, you know, things of that sort. When in fact, when we got there, we heard the concerns. When I left almost 3 years later to the day, I received a proclamation from the mayor of Rossford from the adjoining city for the many things we did to support his city, which we weren't necessarily housed in, such as providing money for fireworks, providing money towards their schools, helping a lot of fundraisers. People's houses would burn down. We'd immediately have our team members go to their aid and bring clothes, food. We paid for their police dog, which helped them recover lots of confiscate lots of drugs and drug money, which that money flowed right back to their police department. So it was just a great story in developing a relationship where, you know, we did it because that's our culture, not because we had to do it.
Right, exactly. And back to you, Chairwoman Pinto. What is your, shall I call it your theme that you mentioned you have?
You mean hungry, homeless, and recovery?
Yes. Tell us about that.
We, the tribe and Penn, have reached out to a couple of nonprofit organizations, and right now we are trying to partner with them. We can't partner with them financially, but we can donate our time. A few weeks ago at the Crisis House, we helped to unload pallets of canned goods and drinks that came to the Crisis House, and we've committed to being there every fourth Tuesday. And same with the Madeline Center, St. Madeline Sophie Center, and Noah's Homes.
Noah's Homes, being right up the street, we see a great opportunity for employment. We've met with Holly, the executive director, and we think that'll be a very natural fit because obviously those residents go out in the community, work all day, and then come home to their group living. So that seems like a very logical partnership right within Humol.
Yes.
These are all nonprofits that we feel that we can relate to.
Looking into the future seven generations, what do you hope to see for the Humol Indian Village tribal members and for the community?
I hope to see healthy tribal members. I hope that they will not have the worry that we had growing up or my parents had. I want them to be able to be self-sufficient in all they do, in their housings, in their educations. Wherever their path takes them, I want them to not worry and have any concerns of, are they going to be able to do this or go to school or wear shoes to be able to go to school. I want a worry-free tribe.
And the community?
And the community is going to benefit, too. They're going to have safer roads, a nice state-of-the-art fire station and equipment.
Yeah, the one thing I'd like to add, too, is as we've seen in virtually every jurisdiction that the local businesses benefit. And when you start driving 3 million visitors a year, give or take, to particular facilities, whether it's a mini-mart, the gas stations, the car wash, the restaurants, and we've met with many of the local operators, and most are very excited and truly see the benefit of this business coming to their community, and they will, you know, their business will grow organically, and those always turn out to be a nice story, you know, in addition to the philanthropic activities and partnerships. So I think all the way around, it's going to be a very, we'd love to be here a year post-opening telling you about the actual successes.
Well, this is our vision today. You're invited back 1 year from today. We'll put it on our calendar.
Good.
Yep. Is anything that we haven't talked about that either of you'd like to talk about or?
You know, from an employment perspective, which I think is on everybody's mind because there's still people looking for jobs, you know, we expect to hire many of our managers by, you know, third and fourth quarter of this year. And by, you know, first quarter of 16, you'll really start to see job fairs, educating, you know, people and residents about the type of jobs we offer and the skills required. And really that big employment push come Q1 of next year. So jobs are coming to Humol. We're looking for good people.
Well, I sure thank you both for being with us. I really appreciate it. And we look forward to more progress out in Humol and wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You are listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, broadcasting from the desert to the sea.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org.
This is Leon Thompson with the Crime Beat Report. A wrong-way driver who crashed into five vehicles at Lemon Grove in San Diego on Wednesday morning has been arrested for drunk driving. Sergeant Michelle McPhail with the San Diego Sheriff says deputies from the Lemon Grove substation responded around 7 a.m. to a collision at the intersection of College Avenue and Federal Boulevard in Lemon Grove. A Ford pickup truck had struck a freeway sign and then headed the wrong way on Federal Boulevard, striking a light pole and a vehicle. He kept going, crossing over a center median and colliding with three more vehicles on College Avenue. He then drove north in the southbound lanes of College Avenue, crossed over the center median again, and turned onto Livingston Street, where he was involved in two more collisions in the city of San Diego. Deputies finally stopped the vehicle and arrested 49-year-old Cosimo Ingrande for driving while intoxicated. He was treated at a hospital for a head laceration. A female driver of another vehicle was also taken to a hospital for treatment of non-life-threatening injuries. Both the Sheriff's Lemon Grove Traffic Division and the San Diego Police Department are investigating these crashes.
Californians often are putting convenience ahead of safety when they use free public wireless networks, according to a new AARP report. It found a quarter of adult internet users access public Wi-Fi at least once a week and are vulnerable to cyber attacks. Amy Nofziger is the director of AARP's Fraud Watch Network.
Recently, AARP conducted a survey of people's online safety and security and found out that tens of thousands admit to engaging in activity that could put them squarely in the sights of hackers looking to steal their personal information. So we thought it was very important to talk about these threats and raise awareness of the risk of cybercrimes.
Nofziger lists four things you should never do on public wireless networks. Don't access your email, credit card, or bank accounts. Make sure the network is authentic, not a fake, using a name similar to that of the coffee shop or hotel. Check your settings. Don't let your device connect automatically to Wi-Fi. And if you must go online to shop, use your cellular signal, which is more secure than Wi-Fi. Nofziger says the FBI estimates more than $800 million was lost through cybercrime in 2014. In response, the AARP has launched the Watch Your Wi-Fi campaign, which provides security tips and details scams frequently used by hackers. Nofziger acknowledges that despite the risks, the internet can be a lifeline.
But we just want to be safe. So use the free public Wi-Fi to surf your favorite sports sites, check the news, check the weather, but do not put any personal or private information into your mobile device or tablet when you're on a free public Wi-Fi.
For more information on how to safely connect on public wireless networks, AARP has a page on its website, aarp.org/watchyourwifi. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
This is Janice Russell, host of People Power, profiling people and organizations making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is Janice Russell with East County Magazine and People Power. I'm here with Mary Luby, the Division Director of Behavioral Health Sciences at Volunteers of America Southwest, to talk about the work they do for veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder, among other topics. Mary, can you give the listeners more details about the Behavioral Health Sciences Division and Volunteers of America Southwest?
Absolutely. So Volunteers of America is a nonprofit organization. We're nationally recognized throughout the country. We have been in business for 119 years serving vulnerable populations. Our mission is to provide individuals and families with the tools needed so that they can improve their well-being and quality of life. Within our organization in Southern California, we focus on serving individuals in the Behavioral Health Division, as well as our social development of children and young families and housing services. Behavioral Health Services, we focus on mental health, alcohol and drug treatment, as well as reintegration services for individuals who have been recently incarcerated. Our veteran services fall underneath our either housing or mental health services. In El Cajon, we have a Holly Veteran Services Center, which is a transitional housing for homeless individuals who struggle with mental health disorders.
Okay, great. And how long has the Veteran Center been opened?
So we've had our location for many years. It recently became Holly Veteran Service Center about 3 years ago.
Can you talk about how Holly Veteran Center can be reached and where exactly it's located?
It's located on Holly Road out in El Cajon, kind of the eastern part of El Cajon. You can look at our website. It's www.voasw.org, and all of the information, including the contact of the program manager, is on that website.
Okay, great. Can you tell us how long you've worked at Holly Veterans Center for?
I have been with the organization for 2 years now and overseeing the program manager for about a year.
And a recent study came out that Vietnam veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder are actually getting worse and not better and still suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. What is your response to the study?
So this is actually a really interesting study. They took 400 veterans that had recently participated in the National Vietnam Veterans Readjustment Study back in the early 90s, and they evaluated these 400 veterans to see where they're at with their mental health disorders. And what they found is that as people age, their PTSD symptoms are either getting worse or remaining the same. And this is accounted to their aging symptoms. As we all know that when you age, you have some of your physical health deteriorates, you have less of a social support system. And so when you combine the PTSD with these aging symptoms, it tends to exacerbate the PTSD symptoms.
Wow, that's interesting. What has your experience been with seeing veterans with PTSD, and what kind of response have you been seeing so far?
So at Holly Veterans Service Center, we serve veterans who are homeless, and they have an array of mental health disorders. Some of them do have PTSD. And what we try to do is that we try to provide them with stable housing first and then coordinate with services out in the community as well as the VA to connect them with their mental health services. And so far, we've been very successful in helping them to stabilize their mental health issues and then receive the treatment that they really need to address their PTSD symptoms.
Okay. And how are veterans referred to the Holly Veterans Center?
So a lot of our referrals come in either through the community or through the VA system itself.
Are there any success stories that you wish to share about veterans overcoming PTSD?
We don't have one specific story that I wanted to share, but I did want to talk about how a lot of our veterans, it's an amazing program because, like I said, we do stabilize people. And the first thing that we focus on is bringing them into housing. And once they're housed and off the street, then they can really address their mental health issues, their income, and all of that. So we've seen success. I think we're at an 86% of moving people from that transitional housing into permanent housing. And at the same time, they've all focused on working on their mental health disorders.
Great. And what can veterans and family members do if veterans are struggling?
So I recommend that, first of all, you really want to talk about the issues. We have a huge stigma in our society of mental health disorders. People tend to steer away from it and not want to talk about it. But when it's addressed, then that's when you can really nail down the situation and get the help that is required. So I recommend that you talk to your family members, whether it's you yourself that reaches out to other family members or you want to address it with, you know, your loved ones. And then look around in our community. We're lucky that we live in San Diego County, and there's so many veteran resources out there. Holly Veterans Service Center is just one of them in our community. 211 is a great resource that they will connect you with the resources in the community based on the need that you have.
That's great. And how can people learn more about Volunteers of America Southwest or their Behavioral Health Sciences Division?
So as I mentioned before, our website is a great resource, www.voasw.org. All of our programs are on there. You're also free to call the contact information on that website and directly call Holly Veterans Services Center.
Okay, great. And what is the process like when veterans first enter into the division or with Holly Veterans Center?
So we do a brief screening when they first call in to make sure that they qualify. The qualifying criteria is that you have to be homeless and you have to have a mental health disorder. And once we do that, then we want to make sure that you are a veteran. So we contact the VA and make sure that you're in the veteran system. If you're not in the system, then we want to make sure that you're enrolled in VA benefits. And then after that, you would come in, you would do an interview with our program manager as well as our VA liaison, and then start the process as moving into the facility.
And is there anything else that you wish to share with listeners?
I just wanted to talk briefly about the stigma. So there's so much mental health stigma in our society, and it often creates barriers. And one of the amazing things that this article talked about is that many people have PTSD as they're aging because they haven't received the treatment that they really need. And it's often because of the stigma. So as a community, I think that we really need to start talking about PTSD and removing those barriers to treatment for everybody who has served our country.
Okay, great. And where can people find this article?
This article, we are posting it on our website, and then there will be a link in the magazine.
You can also look for an article regarding this interview at www.eastcountymagazine.org. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you.
Wildfires are burning throughout the state, and things will only get worse before they get better, says Fire Chief Sam DiGiovanna, a columnist at East County Magazine. If by chance you are near a wildfire, you may be asked to evacuate. There are some things you should know if you find yourself in that situation. It is wise to leave the area as soon as an evacuation is recommended. This will help you avoid being caught in a fire, smoke, or traffic. This will also help firefighters keep roads clear, which allows them to work without obstacles. Call your friends or family who live outside the threatened area and see if they can offer you a space to stay during the evacuation. Your local fire department or city officials will also have designated evacuation shelters. Prepare an emergency kit well before a fire strikes. This kit should include things like a first aid kit, a 3-day supply of non-perishable food, and 3 gallons of water per person, spare keys and cash, and medication. If time allows, then you should pack easily carried valuables, chargers for your cell phone and laptops, and anything irreplaceable such as family photos. Ask friends and family if they can shelter your animals during an emergency. Keep a list of 24-hour numbers for pet-friendly places such as animal shelters, pet boarding facilities, and veterinarians. Be sure to have an animal carrier, food, and water for each pet if you need to evacuate quickly. If you need to go outside while there is an active fire nearby, put on some protective clothing like sturdy shoes, cotton, or woolen clothes, since synthetic fibers can melt, long pants, a long-sleeved shirt, and gloves. For more information, you can visit readyforwildfire.org/evacuation. This has been Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
Welcome. This is Mimi Pollack, host of East County Magazine's Animal Tales. Welcome to Animal Tales. This is Mimi Pollack. I am here today with Ramona wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. Not only is he a renowned photographer with pictures appearing in National Geographic magazine, he also offers guided tours to Africa, Costa Rica, and Alaska. Tuft got his degree as a wildlife biologist, so the focus of these tours is showing you how to photograph indigenous wildlife while having adventures in the wild. Welcome, Roy.
Thanks for having me, Mimi. Happy to be here.
How did you get into wildlife photography?
Well, I was the crazy kid in Poway with the garage full of snakes, right? So right away, everybody knew I loved animals. And so I grew up loving animals, getting out in our local chaparral and watching the hawks and catching snakes and enjoying that. Went on to get a wildlife degree from Cal Poly San Luis Obispo in Northern California and got my first camera as I graduated from college and started taking pictures of what I loved.
What type of camera was it?
It was a Canon AE-1, which was kind of a classic old film camera.
And so the camera inspired you to start taking pictures and combining both the wildlife degree along with the photography?
Yeah, I mean, it's always the animals that were the major interest, and the photography is kind of a stimulus to get you out there, right? And it keeps you out there longer. So it's just kind of a natural thing to want to enjoy your subjects more. You can take images of them and enjoy them when you're back home.
And besides Costa Rica and Alaska, what countries have you been to in Africa, and what other countries have you been to in the world where you've done wildlife photography?
Wow, good question. I've been to, I should count the number of countries I've been to, but in the last 30 years of doing wildlife photography, I've been pretty much all over the world, from Antarctica to Japan and Indonesia and Australia, New Zealand, most of the countries in Africa and Central and South America. So yeah, I guess it'd be easier to say very few places I haven't been at this point.
And after college, how did you move into becoming more of a professional wildlife photographer?
Well, right after college, I started working at the Wild Animal Park here in San Diego. I guess now it's called the Zufari Park, which is always hard for me to remember. And I was doing the bird show there. And it's kind of I think anybody that's been in San Diego for a while knows that bird show. It's been there for 30 years. So I was happy that they asked me to join them there at the bird show. And being at the Wild Animal Park every day, doing my job at the bird show, of course, I'm surrounded by beautiful wildlife, even though it's not really wild, but it gave me an opportunity to get out during breaks and lunch hours with my camera and start taking imagery and work on it and get better at it. And so that really got me going into wildlife photography.
And how did you get connected to National Geographic magazine?
One of my last years working at the park, we had a National Geographic photographer come to the park doing a story on new zoos. And his name was Michael Nick Nichols, really a world-renowned photographer who's done dozens and dozens of stories for National Geographic. Well, everybody at the park knew I was into photography pretty heavily at that point, so they asked Nick if he needed an assistant, and I helped him on that new zoos project. So that kind of got me, you know, a little bit in working with National Geographic, and a couple years later, I went and did a two-year project with Nick on tigers that we spent 2 years photographing wild tigers, and that was kind of the start of my career and a wonderful, you know, mentorship for me to be working with such a well-known and terrific photographer as Nick.
Okay. Tell me more about those 2 years photographing tigers. For example, what exactly did you do while you were there? How did you help Nick? And do you have any memorable moment or story that you can tell us from those years?
Sure. Yeah. So we were working in India, which has the largest population of tigers. And a big part of the story, of course, is doing a natural history portion of the project. So we spent over 2 years photographing a female tiger raising cubs. And so we basically go out every day at 4:30 in the morning on elephant back, because that's the easiest and most accessible way to be close to tigers, is to be on top of an animal that they're not really that nervous about. 7 days a week for 3 months per trip to India. So we did three of those for the natural history portion. And we were photographing tigers, and we'd spend about 10 hours a day in the field and only see tigers about every 5 days on average. So it was a lot of time in the field for very little, you know, return, but it was definitely worth it.
But didn't you also do some groundbreaking work with remote cameras?
Yes, Nick was just really pushing the limits with remote cameras in the field, and tigers being a difficult animal to photograph in person and at close range. He set up seven remote cameras in the jungle with my help. And my main job was to keep those remote cameras running 24/7. A remote camera, if you don't know, is a system where there's an infrared beam, and the animal basically breaks that beam and takes his own picture. And that allowed us to take wide-angle, very intimate shots of tigers that have never been done before. And that was one of our main ways of getting that kind of unique imagery of tigers while we were there.
That sounds very interesting. I imagine you must have gotten some incredible photographs with the remote cameras. Is there any one particular picture that you remember that comes to mind? Or
yeah, actually, and just for the listeners at home, if you have kind of that stack of National Geographic magazines on your library wall. It's 1997 December is the cover issue. And one of the pictures in there was a 50-page story. So it was a huge Nat Geo article. One of the pictures, I placed a camera on a vertical dry waterfall. So it's a rock wall. And we had seen a male tiger jump that chasm where the water would be running if it was actually wet, and to get to another water source. And so we put this camera, set it up so he's jumping right into a 20-millimeter wide lens, which is a very unique perspective. And that camera was there for 3 months, and we had one picture from that 3 months, and it's in the issue, and it's amazing, you know, a male tiger jumping right into the camera midair. So it's one of those, you know, pictures you'd never get in person. You'd have to kind of use this system of remote cameras, and it's much more common nowadays, but when Nick did it, and we did it for the Tiger Project, it was really revolutionary.
I remember that issue. It was just amazing. Now tell me about a memorable moment.
Another memorable moment with tigers is, as I mentioned earlier, we spent a lot of time in elephants following tigers and photographing them, you know, straight and not with a remote camera. Well, at one time, Nick was on one elephant, I was on another elephant, and we have our mahouts, or our drivers, driving the elephants, and we had this one male tiger named Charger that was in this tall grass, and we backed our elephants into the grass to be able to photograph from a perspective down into the grass, and obviously went too close to the tiger as he was feeling pressured. He came up on the back of Nick's elephant, actually jumped onto the rear of the elephant.
Wow.
Which was exciting for everyone, especially the elephants. So the elephants just started spinning and screaming, and we, you know, Nick and I held on for dear life,
and they rotated fast.
Yes, they just spun, you know, just like tornadoes. and just sent the tiger flying. And it was quite an exciting moment. You know, like most things with wildlife photography, when instances like this happen, you know, it's usually because we do something wrong. And it was obviously our fault. We pushed the, you know, we asked the elephants to get too close to the tiger. And he just did what was natural for a tiger, which is, you know, get out of here. And of course, he did it in a very traumatic fashion.
That was probably scary and exciting at the same time.
Yeah, certainly.
And then after, when you finished with doing the tiger shoot, what was the next project you worked on?
Well, after the tiger project, I came home and rested for a while because that was a long project. I actually did an assignment for Audubon Magazine where I went and photographed ocelots in Texas. And it's another cat, a smaller spotted cat. And a lot of people don't know we have ocelots in the United States.
I didn't know that. Ocelots in Texas. What part of Texas?
Yeah, this was in near Laguna Atascosa, so it's way south Texas. The majority of ocelots are found in Central and South America, so this is just kind of a small population coming up into Texas.
Are they endangered?
They are endangered. There's only about 50 ocelots left in Texas in the United States. And so, yeah, I was also using remote cameras again to photograph this elusive cat.
And then what was your next big shoot after that?
Wow. Next big shoot after that. I did another project for Audubon on a rainforest photography and birds. So that was another cover story for Audubon Magazine.
I remember you told me about wolves, that you did something up in Alaska with wolves.
Yeah. You know, right out of college, as I mentioned, I was a wildlife biology major. And right out of college, I did a wolf population study up in Alaska. For the summer, it was, you know, merely a 3-month project putting collars on wolves so we could do a population study. So that was my first time in the field with my new camera. So that was a kind of an exciting time for me.
And then also for, like, I believe it was 3 years, you and your wife opened up a gallery up in Solana Beach on Cedros Avenue, right?
Yeah, we had a beautiful gallery on Cedros in Solana Beach, and it was my wife's idea to kind of show my art to people and be able to have a gallery, and it was fun. We did that and met a lot of local people. When we first moved back to San Diego in the early 2000s, you know, we moved back in 2005.
Where did you live before then?
We were up in the Bay Area for about 8 years, up in Half Moon Bay on the coast south of San Francisco.
But you are a local San Diego boy, right? Where did you grow up?
Yeah, I actually grew up in Poway. So we moved to Poway in 1970. Yeah, I grew up here, went to high school here, went off to college in Northern California, and then we moved around a bit and then came back to kind of the motherland here in Ramona in 2005.
What do you like about living in Ramona?
We love the wilderness experience we have in Ramona. You know, we live on big acreage, which you can still find here in the East County, which is great. And so it's peaceful.
How many acres?
We have 40 acres.
Wow.
Yeah. And
nice.
It's in kind of the big boulder country up there near Mount Woodson. So it's beautiful. Lots of local wildlife. You know, I don't always have to jump on an airplane to get my camera out and photograph wildlife. In fact, this last week, I've spent every morning in a blind photographing our small indigenous fox, our California gray fox, something that actually I've spent no time photographing fox all my years here. They're kind of a tough animal to see. We often see coyotes a lot more, but this is a little bit smaller canid that is more nocturnal, quite a bit more elusive than coyotes. And they're just beautiful. They have a gray color with a cinnamon rust on the chest and their shoulders. Gorgeous, big fluffy tail. And this week I was sitting in a blind photographing a den with 5 kits, and that's what they call young foxes. So what a great, you know, here I am in my backyard. I got my coffee and I walk across the valley, get in my blind and photograph beautiful foxes right here in San Diego County.
I know. I've seen the pictures. They're amazing. Now, you mentioned to me earlier that you have a teaching credential and you enjoy working with people. And so you mentioned to me that in the year 2000, you started organizing photographic expeditions where you would take people to different countries and teach them how to photograph wildlife. Tell us more about that.
Sure. Yeah, that's a big part of my business now is leading photographic tours or safaris. And, you know, it's never a better time than now to take photos. You know, the digital era and digital cameras have made it so much more accessible for people. You know, you're not spending a ton of money on film. You know, you're getting instant feedback from these little TV screens. So you can really progress much quicker than the old days with film. And so, you know, people are finding they want to go out instead of going on a typical vacation and going to some beach and sitting on the beach or going golfing, that there's this whole other avenue for vacations. And, you know, you can combine wildlife viewing, traveling, and learning, you know, something new and exciting. And that's what I do in these wildlife tours. You know, I bring people to Africa or Brazil or Alaska for bears or Mexico, and Costa Rica is one of my all-time favorite destinations. It's close and you have a rainforest right there. So it's a wonderful way to get people out in the field and, you know, try out a new camera, or if they're already an experienced photographer, it's wonderful to go with a pro that already gives you, taking you to the best spots and the best lodges. And so that's a big part of my business. In fact, this year I'll be in the field 160 days running my photo tours.
For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, East County Magazine. Now, I want to go into more detail about these trips. For example, what countries do you go to in Africa?
My main country I go to in Africa is Botswana, a lovely country. It's just north of South Africa, so it's in the southern part of the continent. And I've been going there. This will be my 14th year leading tours to Botswana, so obviously I love it. It's spectacular wildlife. Most people perhaps have heard of the Okavango Delta, which is a very well-known area. It's a floodplain and a desert that creates this oasis for wildlife. And so that's my main destination. Although I have to say next week, I'm going to Tanzania in East Africa, leading a photo trip there. So a couple different countries in Africa I go to.
Getting back to Botswana, do some people go there because of the books, the number one ladies detective agency? Do they ever go there and ask you about that? Or?
Yeah, you know, it's funny you mentioned that. I mean, people who go to Botswana, of course, read those books because it's such an interesting series and it's based in Botswana. I don't think it's the reason they go, obviously, because it's really the wildlife that brings them there, but it's a nice connection.
Yeah. And when people go to Africa, they must think that, you know, they're going to be roughing it. Or why don't you tell us, because I remember you mentioned to me that you want people to know that going to Africa is not going to be roughing it, that it's actually going to be a very pleasant experience in terms of lodging and food and how they take care of you. Why don't you tell us more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I get that a lot, Mimi. I get, you know, isn't it dangerous and aren't you afraid going to Africa? And I think so much of the media reports of, you know, they generalize when they're speaking of the entire continent of Africa, when there's, you know, there's epidemics of something going on or a little bit of violence somewhere. It's a huge continent. And, you know, we're going to a place that's very safe. In fact, the most dangerous part of your African safari will be driving to the airport here in Limburg Field. I mean, being in your car statistically is more dangerous than any other part of the trip. And we're taken care of. It's just really amazing the service level that we get on, in our trips to Africa, the lodging, the food, the wine. Yeah, everything is 5-star. So there's absolutely no roughing it. You know, I have clients that are kind of wonder what big hiking boots they should buy to bring on my trip. And I have to tell them that, you know, I wear Crocs, the most comfortable light slip-on shoe, because we're in vehicles all day. We're not going on death marches. We're not hiking. We're driving around in wonderful vehicles and viewing this wildlife very close and photographing it and then going back for wonderful dinners and wonderful lodging. So it's, you know, it's nothing that you have to worry about roughing it. It's very much a luxury vacation.
I've also heard that the African people themselves are very friendly and very welcoming.
They really are. They are just over the top friendly, just smiles from ear to ear at all times. And so it's a wonderful cultural experience. People that just don't get to travel that much, if it's based on fear, get out there and see some other places around the world, because people are people. And when you go to these communities, they're just so welcoming. And, you know, it's such a joy to see people from around the world and get a different perspective. If you're just always in one location, it's tough to view the world in more than one perspective. So yeah, get out there and travel and see the world and see some beautiful places. That's what I like to do.
Now, what about for the more outdoorsy types, the ones that want to go hiking, the ones that want to have more of an outdoor adventure? What country would you recommend that they take a photographic tour with you, but to where? Like, For somebody who's more of an outdoorsy.
Yeah, if you don't want to be in a vehicle the entire time and you want to get out and physically, you know, hike and enjoy the environment. I actually have several that do that. Costa Rica is a great one. It's close. It's an easy flight. Within 6 hours, you're in prime rainforest and seeing, you know, four species of monkeys and tropical birds, toucans and parrots. It's really mind-boggling, you know, in this day and age. You can just get away for 6-8 hours and you're in this amazing tropical environment. So that's one we definitely get out and hike and experience that rainforest. As I mentioned earlier, I was just in Chile photographing pumas, our mountain lion, same cat. And it's possible there to photograph them on foot. And so we do a lot of hiking in Torres de Peña National Park in Chile. So that's definitely high up. People really want to get their heart rate up and do some hiking along with photography and wildlife viewing. Then that's a great destination.
And now what about Alaska? Tell us about your tours to Alaska.
Well, Alaska is another location that's close and easy to get to. And, you know, we have our own Serengeti right here in the United States, and that is Alaska. So there's nothing like the open spaces up there. I've been leading bear trips up there for over 10 years. And so this is a brown bear excursion where we're out, you know, on foot, hiking and photographing the feeding brown bears. They're feeding on salmon in August on the different rivers in Alaska. So it's another thrilling, large carnivore photography adventure. But once again, we're staying on a boat and it's amazing food and, you know, catching our own halibut and king crab and not much roughing it there either. I guess I'm getting older, maybe, so I don't want to rough it either. So I like to go to destinations that we can, you know, have a nice place to stay and good food and enjoy each other's company and still get out and see wildlife.
Well, you're definitely a people person, so I can see how you would have fun leading these tours. For those of you who just tuned in, this is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, East County Magazine, and this is Mimi Pollack, and I'm talking to wildlife photographer Roy Tuft. When you take your people on these tours to Africa, Costa Rica, Alaska, Chile, tell me two tips to be able to do successful wildlife photography.
Two tips. I think the first thing is patience. When we go out with wildlife, it's not like going to a studio or going to the zoo or where things are just going to perform for you. So I really, you know, I have to set expectations for my clients that we're going to extremely rich areas for wildlife, but there's still an element of being patient. The animals aren't there to please you or entertain you. We're just going in their environment. And obviously I'm taking people to very productive areas where we're going to see some great stuff. But, you know, just be happy to be there. And, you know, and that's my job is to get you in the right spot at the right time and to have wonderful wilderness experiences.
Nice. Is there a website people can go to find out more information?
Sure. My website is toftphoto.com. So my last name, T-O-F as in Frank, T-Photo, P-H-O-T-O.com. And, you know, you can get on there. I have lots of different links to photography and wildlife. I actually have a tours and workshops page, so you want to get on there to see where I'm going, what I'm doing, and feel free to shoot me an email.
All right. Well, thank you very much. And if you would like more information about Roy, look for my article that's coming up in East County Magazine. This is Mimi Pollack of Animal Tales. Thank you very much.
This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road. We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.